Just lobbing us up with thugs who murder, you know, racist thugs, white supremacists who murder innocent people. And then they paralleled Bill Cosby to Emmett Till, and now they're paralleling Bill Cosby to Jesus Christ. I mean, this is not only blasphemous, it just shows the profundity of their depravity.
And we just have 10 seconds, yes. But what this means for Andrea Constant, you as women stood together during this trial.
Yeah, Andrea Constant is the Joan of Arc in the war on rape. She has an outstanding family who has just held her up with tremendous strength and unity, and I just think she's going to go down in history.
Judge O'Neill said to Andrea Constant, "You took her beautiful young spirit and crushed it. No one is above the law. No one should be treated differently or disproportionately," he said to that to Bill Cosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. That was Lily Bernard.
Warning, the following message is only for listeners who contributed during KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. If you did not contribute to KBOO's Fall Membership Drive, please turn off your radio now.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. Your support makes KBOO possible. Thank you.
If you didn't contribute during KBOO's Fall Membership Drive, you may now turn your radio back on.
It's not too late. Go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution right now.
Then the next time this spot plays, you'll be able to listen.
You are listening to 90.7 FM KBOO. Or KBOO Portland, and KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listeners and support from Portland Saturday Market. 45 years of handmade arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, local music in downtown Portland, featuring live events and kids' corners. Portland Saturday Market every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more is available at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. Stay tuned next at 8, which is just around the corner, and in fact, it's at the top of the hour. We're playing Project Censored, has several speeches covering issues from housing, immigration, climate change, and nuclear disarmament. Then at 8, Lisa Loving talks to peace activist Kathy Kelly about colonialism and nonviolence in the face of war. And thanks for listening to KBOO this morning.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. For this week's program, we'll hear some of the sounds of the 2018 Petaluma Progressive Festival held in Northern California, San Francisco Bay Area. This year's event featured political activists addressing issues from immigration to Native people's legal defense to nuclear disarmament. We'll listen to the words of these activists, including keynote speaker Daniel Ellsberg. Stay with us.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. This week on the program, we'll hear some of the speeches from the 2018 Petaluma Progressive Festival in Northern California. Now in its 21st year, this event attracts political activists representing many causes and perspectives. The first voice we'll hear belongs to Bernice Espinosa, an immigration rights attorney with Comité Vida. She'll be followed by housing activist Cynthia Clarkson of the North Bay Organizing Project.
This is civil. We place children in cages. We take babies away from their nursing mothers. We call children aliens. We make babies represent themselves in court, even when they can barely speak any language. We put them in rooms by themselves and we put hoods over their heads. We allow adults to penetrate them. This is civil. We let them die. This is not a penalty. This is not cruel or unusual with our tax dollars because they are not human. This is not a Latinx issue. It's a human rights issue. And since 1996, the government has increased the criminalization of immigrants. However, criminalizing existence is not something new for oppressed people. And it is definitely not something new for people of color, LGBTIQ, and in our recent history where even just loving each other is criminalized. The intersection between criminal law and immigration law, again, is not just a Latinx issue. It's about all people. It's about those people who were on this land before we could even call ourselves immigrants. It's about those people who were brought here onto this land, not by their choice, but because they were told they were not human, because they were labor, they were property. Immigration law and all law that was ever created was made by white male profiteers for one purpose, to protect white male profiteers. And until we understand and recognize that all of the law, as Mr. Dorsey Nunn said, was written for this purpose, we will not be able to reform it unless we decide to dismantle oppression. And the only way that we can do that is with demanding it, uprising and making sure that those babies are not the only children that we look after or the only people. It's easy to get behind immigrant babies pulled away from their mothers. But what about that person who's accused of murder? Will you still be able to stand behind that person and say their time has been served and they're still human? About the father who is separated from their child because they made a decision to cope with their trauma by smoking methamphetamine. And now they're losing their green card. There are over 800,000 people who are losing their status because they're considered not worthy. They've been taken away from temporary protective status, TPS. So not only are those who are here undocumented, they're increasing those who are considered illegal by taking away people's status. Currently, there is an administration that is taking away people's naturalization from 12 years ago because they didn't have their fingerprints up to time or they thought that the documents were fraudulent. Our own communities being attacked. These are people who are working and own restaurants here in our Bay Area, in our towns. The Nepali communities being affected, Eritrean communities being affected, Laotian communities being affected, those who were otherwise told that their countries were not safe enough to return because of massive torture and murder are being forced to return back to their land. We're here for a progressive festival, so let's be progressive. Let's not just talk. Let's not just have little booths and say some things. Let's figure out what we need to do to completely uplift and turn over this system, create systems that are equitable, and stop oppression. I encourage you all to just consider how we can do these things, and not just by coming together, and I'm so thankful that you all are here, but let's uproot the system. Thank you.
Okay, so what is government supposed to do in an emergency? What are they supposed to do? Help, right. Well, when we have fires, when we have floods, all these things, the government calls it a disaster. Well, we are in a disaster. We are in a housing disaster. We have an emergency, and what has government done? Very little. All throughout the Bay Area, people are struggling to find housing. There are more homeless people. There are less people who can afford housing. Let's take a look at our little town of Petaluma. As of February 2018, the median rental for a single-family home was $2,847. The income required for that home is $113,880. The percentage of households that can afford to pay $2,500 in Petaluma is 38%. Households with less than $50,000, 30%. Households with less than $100,000, 62%. Available rentals for those earning less than $75,000 a year, 5. The number of rentals for those earning less than $50,000 a year, 1. That doesn't look very good. According to HUD, a person should not have to pay more than 30% of their income for housing. In Sonoma County, people are paying 50 to 60%. And how many houses were under construction for affordable housing? 0. 36% increase from October 2017 to 2018, 36% increase in people needing rentals. The number of evictions increase 20%. So, what is it about? Sounds to me like it's about greed. Greed! So who does government protect? They're not protecting tenants. Who are they protecting? Developers! Big real estate people. That's who they're there for. So who are we losing in this town of Petaluma because people can't afford to live here anymore? We're losing young people. How many of you have children who can't afford to live here any longer or have to live with you? Seniors on fixed incomes. More, yeah. Working families. Women. Communities of color. These are the people who are hit the hardest. So what do we do? There's not enough housing. You can say, build more affordable housing. Well, that's a great idea, but it doesn't happen like that. And in fact, it's been very slow in Petaluma and Sonoma County. So we have to do something right now to protect our tenants. One thing we can do is pass a just cause eviction clause, which just means a landlord has to have a real reason to evict somebody. And there are real reasons. They didn't pay the rent. They damaged things. They caused a problem in the neighborhood. The family of the landlord wants to move in. Those are real reasons to evict somebody. But people are being evicted with no reason, and they have no recourse. So a bunch of us went to the city council. Was the city council interested in just cause eviction? Absolutely not. Who does the city council represent? Well, I encourage you to talk to our city council members and definitely talk to the people running for city council, because some of them are not representing developers. But many of the people on the city council now are in the hands of developers. Here's what some of our city council people said when we tried to get them to agree to a just cause eviction. So here's what one of our council people said. We don't want to reward bad tenants. Another one said, well, it may stop some developers from building in Petaluma. Well, that shows you who he cares about, and he's still on the city council. It may be a solution in search of a problem. This is a problem. There was a family in Petaluma. The mom was at one of the shelters working. The fires were still raging. She and her husband and her two kids had lived in a house in Petaluma they rented for 10 years. She came home from her volunteer work at the shelter to a notice that she was being evicted. And why? Because the landlord wanted to raise the rent. So another reason we were given is the city can't pay for prosecuting people for this. Should we say we shouldn't have laws against murder because it's too expensive to prosecute people? I mean, what is our city council for? To represent us. So, They voted unanimously not to protect tenants. They voted unanimously, basically, to say they didn't want an inclusive community. I definitely suggest you find out who's getting their money, the people on the city council. I call it the Basin Street Blues. Basin Street is a development company here in Petaluma with a lot of influence. So we have a few things that we can do. In this day and age, we can feel pretty hopeless. There's terrible news all the time. But there are a few things we can do right here, right now, to change things and to change this culture. One is sign the Just Cause Eviction petition. So on the ballot in November is Proposition 10. It's to repeal Costa Hawkins. That is a state law that doesn't allow any kind of rent control or stabilization for units built after 1995. Now, rent control is a dirty word in the real estate world. They all want to say it's a terrible, terrible thing. Well, it may not be the best solution, but it's something. And right now, we don't have affordable housing coming off those trees. We have to do something right now. And repealing Costa Hawkins gives local communities the ability to make their own decisions about how they're going to stabilize rent and protect their tenants. So remember that when you go to vote, Proposition 10.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On this week's program, we're listening to some of the speakers at the 2018 Petaluma Progressive Festival in Northern California. We just heard Cynthia Clarkson, and before her, Bernice Espinosa. We'll continue after we hear a sample of the music from the festival. Please stay with us.
Abriendo paso, caminero, caminando vamos. ¿De dónde vengo y a dónde voy? 'Cause we're gonna look and learn my roots. Just ask where and how I grow no suits in this world of confusion. I will open up all the world of solution. I will learn to be a way. Como zapatista, chicana, indígena, guerrillera, mujer mágica, curandera, plantando semillas de amor. Guerrillera. Creando caminos, abriendo paso, caminero, caminando vamos, guerrillera. Creando caminos, abriendo paso, caminero, caminando vamos. Recordando sin olvidar, recordando para transformar, transformando, tomando cuanto, cada uno consintando, lamento y este sufrimiento. Mi alma es tuyo, es mío. Cuanto más escucho, te siento. Cuanto más escucho, te escucho. Y voy probando. The more that I listen, the more that I feel. The more that I fight, the more that I hear you. And I keep trying.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We just heard music from the group Locura performing at the Petaluma Progressive Festival this August in Northern California. On this week's program, we're listening to some of the speeches from that festival. Now we'll hear from two young people. Charlie Finley is a recent Petaluma High graduate, and Ben Vandermeer, now a senior at Petaluma High, is host of a program at KPCA Radio. Following their remarks, we'll hear the words of Kelsey Hill with Lakota People's Law Project, who will explain an ongoing court case that began at Standing Rock.
Hello, I'm Charlie Finley. I'm a recent Petaluma High graduate. I've lived in the Petaluma area for all of my life, and I have been an attendee of its public school system for around the same amount of time. School was always an exciting thing for me. I'm a big bookworm. A little bit of background. I've grown up around educators my whole life. My parents are both teachers. My mother has been teaching at public schools in the lower grade level since before I was born, and my father has been an art professor at various universities. My grandparents both taught at secondary schools. In fact, my grandmother even taught at Petaluma High for a time. I feel as though my familiarization with the American education system puts me in a position to simultaneously praise and critique it. Our education system benefits many young people, as I'm sure you all know. In fact, according to the National Center for Education Statistics, this year, 50 million children and youth will attend a public school in America. Many of these youth wouldn't be able to access education without it, and many have brighter futures because of it. Public schools allow for youth of many different backgrounds to experience opportunities that they otherwise wouldn't be able to experience. For example, in my high school, the communal support generated by the school allowed for me and many others to fundraise and attend choir festivals and band training sessions. High school, and Petaluma High to me in particular, can be an eye-opening educational experience for many. But however fantastic a school administration may be, however hard teachers and students and parents work together to make schools emotionally and physically safe environments for the students, high school remains a place where youth can be bullied and hurt. It doesn't operate in a vacuum, and it's subject to every ailment that the larger society experiences. High school, like outside of high school, is full of discrimination. It's full of oppressive language, bullying, and violence. It's where kids learn to hide themselves emotionally and to shun others that can be deemed as other or shameful or dirty. And they learn to become desensitized to the bullying and pain that others go through. Nothing is too crude or vile to joke about with teenagers, including rape. Rape culture is present in high schools. I'd like to take a moment to define what rape culture is, as I'm sure not everybody really knows the definition. Rape culture is a society or environment whose prevailing social attitudes have the effect of normalizing or trivializing sexual assault and abuse. So when I see peers and classmates making rape jokes and judging girls' bodies, you should understand that it's not just boys being boys. It is rape culture, and it is prevalent in our schools and amongst our youth. Rape culture is kids being desensitized from the constant outpouring of verbal violence against girls and women. The presence of rape, violence, and everyday sexual objectification have been omniscient in our daily lives since we were children. Before we reach the age of 18, American children will see around 200,000 acts of violence on television, and much of that violence is committed against women. This barrage of violent imagery that the average American child is exposed to sets them up to have less empathy for real women that have experienced physical or sexual violence in their lives. And this attitude carries on into high school. Personally, I don't really think that high school should be a place where people are subject to degradation and slurs. It should be a place for youth to learn. That's why we attend schools, to understand mathematical equations, to write essays on Steinbeck, and to memorize important dates in history. But that's just for surface level of learning. The social learning is equally, if not more, important. I'm sure you all remember your high school years. There are cliques, homecoming dances, and hijinks with friends, and those are the things that really stand out in your memory. In high school, I learned how to navigate social situations, how to talk to people, and how to listen. I wanted to be able to see people beyond what clique or group they happen to be a part of. But not everybody at my school shared my views on open and thoughtful communication. Much more likely, they would pepper hallway chats with so-called offensive humor that perpetrated discrimination against all kinds of people. Many people don't and still don't understand that how they speak has a real effect on real people. They don't understand that they're perpetuating rape culture. They don't even know what rape culture is. Despite the Me Too movement and its highly publicized following, many youth don't understand that it's connected to their everyday lives in school. For example, the dress code. At many schools, including Petaluma High, the dress code is put in place to maintain a space where students can learn without distraction. This is so commonplace in schools that sometimes we forget to stop for a moment and think about what the word distraction implies. Let's think about that for a second. Distraction. This distraction is the female student whose bare shoulder, or God forbid, mid-thigh, could potentially arouse the male student. This dress code is telling female students that their male classmates cannot control their urges, and it's telling the male students that they are expected to have a difficult time behaving properly. Essentially, high school dress codes inform teens that the female body is not private and that it's subject and should be subject to frequent sexualization, that a girl's body is not her own. And this isn't only at high schools. Most elementary schools have these same dress codes. Fifth grade girls ages 10 to 11 get sent home and denied education for being distracting for boys. This insinuates that it's their fault for being distracting, that it's their fault for being viewed as sexual objects, even at such a young age. The focus has to shift from dress codes to classroom conversations about the privacy of each individual's body. I'd like to shift my talk to be a little more personal about my experience at Petaluma High. Rape culture is present from the moment you step foot into the main hallway of the school and continues to follow you from class to class, even making its way into your own social circle. It's difficult to fight against the flood of casual discrimination at school. It can even exist amongst your friends. In my social circle for the last few years, I've had a friend that embodied casual discrimination. He was one of the many people at Petaluma High that didn't believe in the existence of rape culture at all. His borderline jokes and offensive and abusive comments were laughing points for those of us in the friend group, and most of the time we'd laugh at his comments. Like many of the boys at school, he would slut-shame almost any girl, even shaming those of us in the group and often to our faces. None of us fought it, and few defended the girls he would pick on. It was a running joke in the group that he didn't believe in rape culture, and sadly, I know many others who share the same view. But it doesn't have to be this way in schools. It doesn't have to be this way in Petaluma High School. The human interaction teachers at Petaluma High emphasize consensual culture, and the clubs on campus, such as the Feminist Club and the Gender and Sexualities Alliance, are very active. We can work with the administration in schools. We can change the script, and we can educate more youth about what rape culture is and how it affects others. But we need to work with the school administrations. They need to understand that this is an important issue and that it affects the lives of many, many youth and many young adults. And I believe that we can do it together if we only learn how to communicate more efficiently. Thank you.
Hello. It's nice to see lots of you. My name is Ben Vandermeer. I am 17 years old. I am a senior at Petaluma High School, and I'm just so happy to see all of you here out today. It's a great turnout. It's always a fun event here in Petaluma. So I got to ask, how's the slow implosion of the world going for everybody? Going good? Going good? See some mixed response from everybody? All right. That's good. Well, I got to say, this is great. A while back, actually, earlier this year, I got an amazing opportunity to be a part of another kind of event like this over at the March for Our Lives in Santa Rosa. That was lots of fun. Don't know. It's a little thing, little like indie organization. Don't know if any of you guys have heard about it. It was fun. It's a great time, and they were so inspiring to see so many young, happy, active activists ready to go out and kind of change democracy from the front lines. Now, let's be real, folks. This nation is a hijacked bus, and it's already 3/4 off the cliff. So let's just hand over the keys to those in charge and see the best they can do. At the March for Our Lives, it was very inspiring. And after the event, it was really cool. Some people would come up and they'd be like, I gotta tell you, you guys are the future. And this was really sweet. Granted, this was a really nice thing to say. But I never really have been a fan of that saying, you guys are the future, because it focuses on what kids will be later on in time and not necessarily what they are now. She gets it. Friendly understands what I'm saying over there. Sorry. I know the previous speaker from high school. We go to the same school. Anyways, it was just really interesting because they'd say these things like, you guys are the future, or I can't wait to see what you guys will do. And it just kind of perpetuates this idea that the value of a child or a teenager is only determined by what they will be, you know? They will be voters. They will be buyers. They'll be followers and leaders and mighty warriors. They will be cogs in the machine that is responsible for society's dissolution. But they will not be kids. And I would argue that being a kid is the most powerful position that you can be in. You know, it's the empty slate. It's the canvas on which life itself is painted. But I mean, what do I know in reality? I'm just a kid. So I guess to make a short point, we, the next generation, are not necessarily the future. We're the now. We're not going anywhere anytime soon, so thank you.
I am the social media specialist and intern program director for the Lakota People's Law Project. We are based in part in Santa Cruz, California, where our legal team normally resides. We also have elders and people on staff in North and South Dakota in the Ocheti Chocoan. So, you know, we're kind of a weird collaborative project, but we've been doing a lot of really great work for the last 10 years. But specifically the last 2-3 years, we've focused to kind of pivot toward where the pipeline fight. So how many of you maybe followed this stuff at Standing Rock, what happened with the No Dapple movement? Awesome. All right. How many of you have maybe heard the news about Chase Ironize's case? Cool. All right. So just a small background for anybody that doesn't know. Chase Ironize ran for Congress in 2016. He got the most votes of any Democratic nominee ever in the state. He did lose. But he took a peaceful, prayerful stand on February 1st, 2017 against the Dakota Access Pipeline. He took a stand at what they called Last Child's Camp in an homage to Crazy Horse. So Chase Ironize was railroaded as a leader, and they charged him with felony incitement of a riot and felony criminal trespass. So I'd like to reiterate, the felony criminal trespass is especially ironic given that Chase Ironize is a lifelong Standing Rock Sioux tribal member, as well as the land that he took this stand on is unceded 1851 treaty land. So how does a Lakota person trespass on treaty land? Anyway, this week we have gotten a really big development in the legal case that has actually resulted in the conclusion of his No Dapple trial. So the prosecutors in North Dakota actually announced to our legal team about a week ago that they have dropped the felony incitement of a riot and criminal trespass charges. Yeah. So on this last Thursday, we were actually supposed to have a hearing in Mandan, North Dakota, concerning the use of a necessity defense. Does anybody here know what a necessity defense is? I ask because it's starting to become a really pivotal thing in the climate movement as a whole, not just the indigenous side, but also everybody that's organizing for climate justice in the United States. So typically, a necessity defense has referred to if you have to drive a car to get somebody to the hospital, but you don't have a driver's license, you would claim a defense of necessity because it was necessary for you to do it. So we were going to argue that in Chase Ironize's case, that he had no other option because his children drink the water that the Dakota Access Pipeline actually pumps under. It's the sole drinking source of water for the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. So as a Lakota man, he had no choice but to stand up against it. And so our hearing on Thursday was going to be about the use of a necessity defense, whether or not we could use it. I just wanted to point out that it's really important to note that the prosecutors in the state of North Dakota who tried to throw the book at Chase Ironize backed out of having to argue that A, prayer was a riot, and B, you can trespass on treaty land. So Chase actually did sign a plea deal, and it was signed late Tuesday night by Judge Chris Christofferson in North Dakota. And the plea deal, in place of his felony charges, he signed a plea deal pleading guilty to disorderly conduct. Now, while a lot of people have said to me, well, I wouldn't plead guilty to anything I didn't do, anything that I didn't think was unlawful or wrong, Chase, with the felony charges, was facing 6 years in prison, being away from his wife and kids, from his ancestral homelands, and also losing his law license. Now, signing the plea deal with a disorderly conduct misdemeanor, he has informal probation for the next 360 days, and those records will be sealed if he does not break the law in the next year. So the gamble is obviously much better for him. So everybody kind of thought that Chase Ironize's No Dapple case was going to be the last case of all of the Standing Rock criminal cases, but it looks like there's actually about four or five more. So pay attention to those. Lakota People's Law Project, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, website, really good place to stay updated on not just the Standing Rock pipeline fight, but we also try to keep tabs on every other pipeline fight on Turtle Island. So to pivot to kind of what we're doing post-Standing Rock, we have a petition. We have a petition to implement renewable portfolio standards on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, and as we'd like to move it to Cheyenne River and Pine Ridge as well. So Standing Rock and North and South Dakota as a whole actually have the top five wind, solar, geothermal, and hydro potential in the United States. So the fact that they're not using their renewable capability when they can is simply because South and North Dakota love their coal and oil, or at least the people in power in North and South Dakota love their coal and oil. But unlike other most cold states like Wisconsin, Massachusetts, Maryland, etc., North and South Dakota can turn the utilities off in the dead of winter. So that means that people that cannot pay on Standing Rock, sometimes, like, you know, death happens on Standing Rock because people cannot pay their utility bills. And there's this really long, complicated history with housing development on Standing Rock and on Native reservations. So we're trying to create energy sovereignty. If you would like to sign the petition to green the Standing Rock Res, lastly, we have an open letter to Trump that you can find on lakotalaw.org. We're asking Trump to stop identifying environmental activists as terrorists. So we're doing a lot of really awesome work. Please come talk to me. And I'm really, really excited to be here. And thank you so much. Have a good day.
That was Kelsey Hill from the Lakota People's Law Project speaking at the Petaluma Progressive Festival this past August. After this musical break, we'll hear from author and whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. Stay with us.
Tiene hambre, la luna tiene hambre, la tierra tiene hambre, tú tienes hambre, mi cuerpo tiene hambre, tu mente tiene hambre, que no tiene hambre, dale, 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 dale.
Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're listening to speeches from the Petaluma Progressive Festival from August 26th this year. The festival is now in its 21st year. Now, we'll hear the keynote address from that event delivered by Daniel Ellsberg. Famous as the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers to the press in 1971, Daniel Ellsberg has also spoken out against wars and in support of later whistleblowers such as Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, and others. Ellsberg's latest book is The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Here is Daniel Ellsberg.
On such a beautiful day, I really don't want to talk to you about the subject of my latest book, which is The Nuclear Arms Race. I'm at this moment seeing no prospects for improvement on that anywhere I look. And I just hate to be a total downer, as a matter of fact. Something that strikes me as I read the paper today is how true it is that politicians are a mixed bag and that you can't expect any one of them to be doing the right thing all the time or even not the wrong thing. We have an obituary of John McCain. As we all know, he was mostly on the side opposite from all of us in the last 20 years, but not all the time. He did some good things. My feeling is colored by something that we'll never get in his obituaries, but which I read in a biography of him a couple of times, learning that in the last days of my trial, back in 1973, as all the Watergate stuff was coming out, John McCain, just out of a POW camp, and in the false belief that Nixon had gotten him out, whereas in fact Nixon had kept the war going in an effort to keep President Thieu, the man who, by the way, elected him, that's another story, but to keep him in power throughout the time that Nixon was in power, which he did. Thieu outlasted Nixon, as a matter of fact. But anyway, in those last days of my trial, a year before Nixon had to resign, John McCain had testified just out of the POW camp to come testify against me on character grounds. Well, he didn't know me. He didn't know the Pentagon Papers. He didn't know much about Vietnam at all. He'd been in a prisoner of war camp for 5.5 years. They didn't give him a lot of news then. He hadn't been reading the Pentagon Papers in that prison camp. But he came to testify that I had greatly damaged the national security. And to the end of his life, he believed that that war was winnable and should have been won, and it was a treachery by the home front, including me, that had kept it. Bad. Really bad. On the other hand, as we all know, he and John Kerry did foster the bill that got recognition for Vietnam eventually. He did a number of other things, including on finance reform. He did go against his party on a number of things. He ended up by opposing Trump, and of course, one of his last acts was turns thumbs down on the repeal of the Obamacare. So, yeah, so there are good things to remember. You can read in the paper a saint of ours, you know, a prophet, basically, An Yang Suu Kyi, and the fact that she's turned her back on some 700,000 Rohingya who are suffering, deported or killed, tortured, to stay in power, which I have learned at 87 is what humans in power do, mostly males. Of course, she's the rare female. But when it comes to staying in power, they will pretty much do anything and kill any number of people. When I talk about mixed bags or how anybody can be in denial, which is what I believe, but let me make that a more general thing. I believe every human is capable of and generally has exhibited denial, stupidity, refusal to look at evidence on one area or another where to do otherwise would hurt their associations, their relationships, their job, their career, their membership in favored groups that they want. So they turn away from it. I'm a living example of that, obviously. The subtitle of my book is Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. That was partly rhetorical when I put that on when I made the proposal. It's called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Well, I thought, okay, that's kind of an attention grabber. I did reject a suggestion that was made to me very strongly by somebody who knew marketing very well, Confessions of a Nuclear Terrorist. And I thought of that hard. There's no question the plans I were participating in, like all nuclear plans of the 9 nuclear weapon states, were plans for nuclear terrorism, for killing civilians en masse for a political purpose, unarmed people. That's what a nuclear weapon is for, and that's what my book is about. Well, I participated in those plans for years. I allowed myself to believe that there was a missile gap, that we were holding off the Soviets from a use of their hundreds to thousands of nuclear weapons, supposedly, in a surprise attack by being able to deter it. I believed that. I did what I did, not to have a nuclear war, but to prevent one, to deter it. And it wasn't until 1961, years after working on those plans and writing plans for deterrence, that I discovered from our reconnaissance satellites that the Russians had not the 1,000 missiles, which I had just heard estimated at Strategic Air Command, SAC headquarters at Offutt Field in Omaha, 1,000. What they had was 4. So it was not just that there wasn't a missile gap, it was that our estimates were entirely based on a totally wrong framework, and it should have led to an entire reconsideration of the Cold War and what was possible to avoid it. We had gone on the assumption for years, and I'd accepted this, that having been 15 when the war ended and grown up on World War II, I accepted the basic premise of the Cold War that Stalin and Russia in general is Hitler with nukes. Seemed very ominous and not implausible. They did test an ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile, before we were able to, months ahead. So there was a notion that they must be ahead of us, and naturally they were doing with that possibility what we would have done with it, build a first strike capability against the adversary and either blackmail them or actually wipe them out. It seemed plausible enough, but when they realized that they had not made any effort to build on that technical achievement by building a first strike force, that should have led to the notion, what else were we wrong about? Maybe this whole thing is wrong. The idea of Hitler with nuclear weapons, and by the way, that is coming back from both parties looking at Russia, but the idea of that was meant no negotiation. It's useless to talk to these people. It's useless to negotiate with them, just as I would have to agree, it was useless to negotiate with Hitler and would not have done it. It was not true of the Soviets ever. But instead of considering the possibility in 1961 that since they hadn't built hardly any missiles without an agreement while we were going full steam ahead, maybe with an agreement constraining our buildup and our missile tests, you could hold them down to that. No thought of that by anybody, and I have to admit, by me either. I went off in a different direction. That's in my book. But the point is, it just was not considered because it was just too useful to have a Hitler-like enemy with whom you couldn't negotiate. You could only build up and prepare and spend and fulfill contracts to Boeing and Lockheed and Northrop Grumman and General Dynamics, keep people busy working, keep the production lines going, building 1,000 Minutemen missiles at a time when they had 4. Better to do that than to change the whole arrangement. And our relations with Europe, which were based on protecting Europe from this supposedly Hitler-like expansionist power. And let me just say, not to go into the whole story, the plausibility of that came to the idea that they were occupying East Europe. But the idea that they were doing that to defend against the Germany that we were rearming and which had occupied them twice in the last century, and before that with Napoleon, that idea wasn't part of the discussion at all on our side. When I say denial, you know, stupidity, and these were very smart people. We are approaching, we're well advanced into a new Cold War right now with the demonization of Russia and Putin. And the idea, you can't negotiate, whether it's Syria, Ukraine, anything else, climate, is as dangerous now as it was then and as wrong now. When Trump, of all people, proposed to go to a summit with North Korea, we'll see what comes of that. But when he proposed to do it and did do it, he was opposed by the Democratic Party. Said, you can't talk to these people. What's the use? He'll give something away. Give away with respect to North Korea? You know, what is the problem here exactly? The idea that Trump might get credit for some degree of negotiation or peacemaking, the Democrats showed their hand on that one. Anathema. Nothing counted but going against Trump. Now, there's a lot to go against there. He has one thing to be said for him that I know of. One thing that was during the campaign and since. He was saying, why can't we collaborate with Russia? Why can't we be friends with Russia? Why can't we cooperate in various ways? I agreed with that. Now, with that, he was against the elite of his own party, including McCain, very much so, but also Hillary Clinton. And really, this movement had started under Barack Obama, whether much on his part, I don't know. But the system was moving toward that idea that you can't negotiate with these people at all. Why is Trump saying we should collaborate with Russia? We can collaborate. Because it's sane and he's sane? Well, it is sane, but, you know, his sanity is not the first explanation that comes to mind on that. My own guess, and there's no proof in court yet, but I think there will be, actually, that the reason is heavy blackmail on Trump and of the kind that Michael Cohen was protecting him against here on the domestic front, other stuff like that, and $800 or $900 million of laundered money, of drug money and crime money and whatever in Russia. Not good. Nevertheless, if the upshot of that is not to go to war with Russia over Syria or Ukraine, I'm on that side. That is about the only thing you can say for him. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a very stout Democrat, and one that I had to admit that, being a California voter, I had not voted for Hillary Clinton. I wrote in Bernie Sanders on my ballot in California. Nevertheless, I'm saying, on foreign policy, what can you tell me where the Democrats are actually better than Trump? And so she was thinking. There was a pause there, and then her friend said, why don't you get a cookie and give her time to think about this? And I came back, and she said, I've got it. Paris Accords. That's true, actually. I was going to say, wrongly, I have been saying, the single nation with a leader who denies climate change is our country, is our leader. And the single majority party that denies human-caused climate change is the Republican Party, which is what leads Noam Chomsky to call it the most dangerous organization in human history, doing everything to dump toxics and dump CO2 and oil into the atmosphere instead of the inadequate moves that the Democrats would have made, but they would not have taken this rhetorical position. I really thought he was the only climate denier, and somebody referred me to the web and confirmed what I was surprised to hear. There is one other, Putin, who when Trump came in said about Scott Pruitt, the recent head of EPA, Pruitt is maybe right. He's sensible. The doubters may be right here. Now, why would Putin be saying this, for God's sake? As somebody else said to him, the difference between him and Trump is he's not delusional. But this one is delusional. He's saying doubts are right and so forth. He's got an Arctic full of oil that he wants to dump into the atmosphere. And that's why he loved Tillerson. And that's why Tillerson loved him, basically. Not on our side on this issue. The point is, in other words, you have to be prepared on the issues to see which one you back on which issue and to what extent. The fact is, I would say, I'm just going to mention it, there is really little more important than trying to dismantle the doomsday machines in both the U.S. and Russia, and to a lesser extent in the other nuclear weapon states, which threaten most life on Earth through nuclear winter. That should have been done years ago. It should have been done at the end of the first Cold War, but we're not moving in that direction, that's for sure. On the climate, the nuclear problem is a problem of not something that's happening every day to make things worse. Actually, I would say, as somebody who's really followed this very closely, the danger, the actual stakes of nuclear winter have been pretty much with the world since 1952 under Harry Truman. His 1,000 fission weapons, and I certainly voted for him then, his 1,000 fission weapons then, not H-bombs, targeted against cities as they would have been in a Berlin crisis or a Cuban crisis, would have caused smoke that would have canceled enough sunlight to kill most people on Earth by starvation within a year. That was 1950. And there was 2 doomsday machines like that from the mid-60s. Since then, the scale of the thing has not actually increased that much or decreased at all. We've gotten rid of 85% of the weapons since the end of the Cold War. 85%. And what has that done for the safety of us and the world? Nothing. Not the slightest bit. We continue to have, with our 1,500 weapons on alert and their 1,500 on alert, continue to have far more than is necessary to cause starvation, nuclear winter that will kill nearly everybody, and still on hair triggers, intercontinental ballistic missiles on both sides. As I said, by the way, then they had 4. We had only 40, 10 times as much ICBMs. But instead of stopping that race in 61, we went to 1,000. They went to 1,000. Multiple warheads. And it's been that way ever since, enormously. So getting down from the nearly 70,000 nuclear weapons that we had at the peak down to some 15,000, well, isn't that wonderful? No. They're still on hair triggers. They're still ready to go in case of a false alarm. But it's not getting worse from day to day. The climate is getting worse from day to day. Every week, every month, every year, it gets worse. And we get closer to a tipping point that will make it irreversible. Can we look to either party to act adequately on that? Adequately, no. But between the two parties, there is a difference between terrible and even worse. And that's the difference we've been facing on many issues for a lot of reasons. In some, the Democrats haven't been so terrible in some domestic issues. Republicans, pretty much across the board, but never so much as now. This is something unusual domestically, but how unusual in terms of who we are as America. At 87, which is what I am now, I learned more after Charlottesville last year about the causes of the Civil War and the nature of the Civil War and what our country is than in my previous 86 years. And not to go into that too much, I'll put it in these terms. I've said from this platform, and I've said it other times, we progressives, we socialists, anarchists, left libertarians, whatever, the people who are trying to make a better world, and not by making the world more dangerous so as to make ourselves more safe and everyone else less safe, we are a minority. We're even a small minority. I now would say we are, by the way, a minority less large, even smaller, than another large minority. And that other large minority, which we saw spoken for at Charlottesville, they didn't speak for everybody, is racist, misogynist, homophobic, essentially fascist, authoritarian. We are a minority, but we are enough to make a difference in opposing these people. In this election, people think, do we have any stake in what happens to Mueller and the impeachment and all this with Pence waiting in the wings? That's daunting indeed. But when it comes to having a Democratic Congress facing Pence or Trump rather than a Republican one, that's not a hard problem. That's not a dilemma. That's not a recipe for staying home and letting these guys fight it out. There has to be a Democratic House, preferably a Senate later, sooner, not just for impeachment, and not enough by itself by any means. It has to be a Democratic Party in which Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez is typical. In general, progressives, yes, that's who we need, not the Democrats of the past who have ignored climate, ignored nuclear, ignored inequity, inequality, worked for corporations. Yes, the Democratic Party is as bad as any leftist has ever said it was. But to say that the Republicans are not worse is, to me, denial, madness, on the level of the climate change deniers, I would have to say. Out of it, totally. So our job has not ended if we get a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president. The arms race was built up under Democratic presidents, no question about it. But our chance for change is coming from a new kind of politician. Now, they won't be perfect either. I'm sure Alexandria will turn out to have some limitation. Who doesn't? For one thing, she doesn't talk about foreign policy at all, any more than Bernie Sanders did much, or Elizabeth Warren, who I love, all these people. But they don't talk about conversion of the economy. They don't talk about the military-industrial complex. We've got to get them started on that and do it. So that is up to us, and thank you for being here.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty...
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KABU is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KABU will be hosting Killer of Sheep on Wednesday, October 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Filmed in Watts in 1975, Killer of Sheep follows a working man in a moment of existential crisis, trying to make ends meet at a job he finds repugnant, and trying to connect with his family and community. The Library of Congress declared Killer of Sheep a national treasure and one of the first 50 films on the National Film Registry. Again, that's Killer of Sheep on Wednesday, October 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival, taking place September 27th through 30th at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The Portland Eco Film Festival is the premier environmental film festival in the U.S. Pacific Northwest. This year, the festival will screen the films The Beaver Believers, Dirt Rich, The Kingdom, How Fungi Made the World, B-Sharp Honeybee, and Elephant Path. Again, that's the Portland Eco Film Festival, taking place September 27th through 30th at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Hey, coming right up, we've got political perspectives. Today, Lisa Loving talks to peace activist Kathy Kelly. She's right here in the studio. They'll be talking about colonialism and nonviolence in the face of war. At 10 o'clock, Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, and then at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11 o'clock, The Recovery Zone talks to the organizers of the 2018 Radical Mycology Convergence for fungus lovers, artists, and activists. And please keep in mind that all these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. And if you'd like to become a member, you can go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Let's see if we can get some music for Lisa, and then stay tuned for her conversation with Kathy Kelly.